In progress.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm Trish King. And I just do consults and classes now. So I had a consult yesterday with somebody who adopted a 10-year-old deaf Cocker Spaniel from Muttville. And darlingest dog you ever saw. This is one of the nicest consults I've ever been to. I walk in there and I'm like, they said, "We've never had a dog before. We want you to tell us what to do." And this dog is like, "Sits on your lap." "Is it okay to sit on my lap?" "Yes, it's just fine to sit on your lap. That's okay." And I said, "You don't take him off leash because he can't hear. He's probably more like 12 or 13. He's pretty old." This is an elderly couple, and they've never had a dog before, so this is just perfect. He follows them from room to room, and they said he kind of gets in the way in the kitchen. And I said, "Well, see that space right down there? Put a bed in there." Ta-da! That actually followed a consult with a aggressive pit bull who had bitten a couple people, and it was very dog aggressive. And the first time I saw them was back in the fall, and they had two dogs at that time, Diablo and Zumadi, and then Diablo died. He got cancer, and he was the outgoing, friendly, happy dog, and Zumadi was the not very happy, not very outgoing, aggressive dog. So but his behavior has changed. And one of the interesting things about this for me is they wanted me to come and see them again because the behavior has changed. He's suddenly much calmer. And he's not as reactive. He's still reactive to people and he's still reactive to dog, but it's gotten a lot better. So in discussions with them about it, what I had noted in the previous consult, and it really is true, was that the two dogs, Diablo and Zumadi, actually competed all the time. And so you know what happened. Then their energy level, this actually addresses what we were talking about, because their energy level was really high all the time, and his anxiety level is really high all the time. So not that they didn't get along. They did get along. But they would escalate into minor fighting sometimes. They always were competing over the same object. "I got a bone, you want that bone," or, you know, "I want your bone," or "I want your food," or "I want your whatever." So they were, the people's tension also was high because they wanted to make sure that everything was going to work out with these two dogs. These are great, great people. And luckily, the husband works with autistic kids. And one of the interesting things that was brought out in the first consult, and we talked about the things that I had said to them that made a huge difference to them, is that they had gotten a couple of trainers whose first response to Zumadi's problem was to use a pinch collar and an e-collar. So that whenever he did anything that they didn't like, they would, and they said, they were like that kind of thing with this pinch collar, and then they would nail him with the e-collar. And that's kind of how he was taught to respond. And his behavior actually escalated rather than de-escalated, which, you know, we can see why that might be the case. But but when I came to talk to them, and remember when we were talking about, you know, real life consults and whatnot, you don't say, "Boy, that was a stupid thing to do." Yeah, you know, there's no way you're going to go that direction. So I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with a pinch collar, and there's actually nothing wrong with a e-collar. Let's just see what else we can do." And so when I talked to them yesterday, they said one of the biggest things that I said to them that made life completely different for them was that Zumadi did not know what he was meant to be doing. He only knew what was wrong. So, and he didn't even know that was wrong. And I think this comes from people. People think that dogs know the difference between right and wrong. Anybody seen this? They think, well, the dog knows he shouldn't pull. No, why would he know he shouldn't pull? He's a dog, you know. Or he knows it's bad to bite people. No, he doesn't. He gets defensive. He bites a person. He always bit their hand. It was always when it was coming down towards his head. But now, of course, the owners are really afraid of him, so he's muzzled all the time. So we just ordered him a Bumas muzzle, the good muzzles, because I think he's always going to be muzzled. I can't imagine And we put him on CBD, and that was wonderful. They said it was major, made a huge, huge difference. So, you remember, sometimes CBD makes a difference, and sometimes it makes no difference whatsoever. But in this case, it did make a difference. The other thing they said that was absolutely spectacular, and we talked about this earlier, was I said, walk in the middle of the street. Don't walk on the sidewalk. Walk on the middle of the street. And they said they live in an area in Berkeley. You know, Berkeley doesn't have streets that don't have cars on them. But anyway, there's a lot of meridians where they live. And so he walks on the meridian. And Zamati is going, okay, I'm good. Because he has this space between him and the other dogs and between him and the other people, and he's really good. So I did meet him yesterday. The first time, I never even met him. He didn't come out of the crate. They were too afraid that he was going to headbutt me, if nothing else, if he had a muzzle on. But yesterday, we actually played a little bit. And he did really well, which is nice.
And he was muzzled?
Pardon?
He was muzzled the whole time?
Yes, he was muzzled the whole time. There's no way I want to put them at risk. I don't think he would have bitten me because I have a tendency to keep my hands to myself. But it's still, you have to be careful with that. I saw a Leon Berger this week, who also has the same kind of problem, and my hands right up like this the whole time. There's no way I'm going to let you know.
Molly's looks like she might have
a problem. Oh, can she not come down?
She's trying to go up, but she can't really get up.
She's doing it. She's doing it. She's got it. She still can't figure out how to open the door. But, yeah.
I think she saw the space between the steps when she got tired.
Yeah. She probably got a little bit nervous about that. Okay, so there was a question over here.
Oh, I was wondering if the dog that walked in the meridian, did he react to dogs on the sidewalk?
Nope.
Or no, as long as he had that kind of
As long
space.
As he's got the space. Remember, they all have space needs, right?
Yeah. But and when he'd see them,
he was okay, you know. And, oh, the thing is that the trainer had told him the same thing that I told him, essentially, is that the problem with pit bulls is they stare. So when they stare, they make other dogs get nervous, and they also will kind of get nervous themselves. It's almost like they're doing something that they have no control over, but it still makes them get really nervous and really anxious. So they do it, right? But that was what they were hitting the e-collar for. So anytime he stared at another dog, they'd hit the e-collar. And I said, well, how about just saying his name and giving him a treat, you know, like something really hard? And so as long as he's got space, he can do that. So as long as he's on the meridian, he can do that. And but if he's too close, then he's not going to be able to bring himself to do that, you know.
And then he starts staring at
Yeah, and then he'll start staring at the other dogs.
Then they get distracted.
Yeah. Well, you know. You're a good girl, Molly. She is adopted by tomorrow, by the way. She's actually going to her home tomorrow. She's 8 years old. She was owned by a woman who died. Okay, so anyway, so these are relevant. The Zamati thing, of course, the reason I bring it up is because it happened yesterday. Can I remember a consult that happened on Friday? I don't think so. I'd have to look it up. Oh, but did I tell you about the psychic lady?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry. This is totally irrelevant to this, but I have to tell you anyway. So this woman calls me up. She's lived in Colorado. She's just moved out to California. She has two dogs who are pit mixes, one's 8, one's 7, I think. They were not neutered till very late. They always got along beautifully, never had a problem, and then they started to fight at about 5 and 6 years old, or 4 and 5 years old, something like that, a couple of years ago anyway. And so she neutered one. That didn't solve it. So she neutered the other one. That didn't solve it. So they fight and they hurt each other. They send each other to the vet. And, you know, that's kind of a big, like, boom, boom, boom. If this is going to happen, is very little you can do about it because they don't like each other. So she has kind of gone, had one of the dogs live at a friend's house for up to 8 months at a time while she, you know, is trying to move around and do all kinds of stuff. But she's now in California. She wants to stay here. She wants everybody, the family, back together again. So I go to her house, and I get to her house, and she's this, has these very intense, talk about pit bull eyes. She's got very intense staring eyes. And I said, hello, and she goes, hello. Okay, how are you? And she said, come in, except for she thought I was supposed to come at a different time, which I wasn't. It wasn't my fault for once. And so I get inside, and there's one of the dogs is behind one gate, and one of the dogs is outside. And so she took me up to the dog behind the gate, who is a very, both of these dogs, by the way, just lovely, lovely dogs. Really nice, really friendly, friendly to people, friendly to other dogs. There's nothing wrong with these dogs except for they don't like to live together. So she goes, this is really true. She goes, Trish, I want you to tell Majid why you're here. I said, I beg your pardon? She said, tell Majid why you are here. I need to know. He needs to know. He's a sentient being. He understands everything we say. You need to tell him. And I'm like, I'm here to try to tell us to have the dogs live with each other. And I have no problem with animal communicators, but this was weird. This was really weird. So then I said, you know, I don't think I'm the trainer for you. Because this is not, I think I do know what dogs are thinking, but I'm not at all egotistical enough to think that I can actually tell them what I want and have them tell me something in return. It just doesn't happen with me. Maybe it does with other people. Anyway, so I thought, well, we'll just end this now. An hour and 45 minutes later, I'm still there. And she's done a lot of management, and her management is excellent. I mean, she has big, big gates up and all that kind of stuff. And she kept on saying, I know they like each other. I know they like each other. It is just, they just need to get this, the spirit together. And, you know, so I suggested Prozac, you know.
And CBD. So,
yeah, whatever. Anyway, so what I should have said, honest to God, I should have said, he's telling me he hates his brother. And he doesn't ever want to live with him. And why the hell do you have the other dog here? That's what I should have said. And that would have ended it right there, right? Instead of kind of me going, okay, whatever you want. So anyway, towards the end of the consult, she goes, excuse me, I have to feed my cat. So she goes into another room and she brings out what looked like a dead ball of fur. It's a 23-year-old cat. And it's almost dead. I mean, the dog can't move. The cat can't move. And it got this gray fur that was kind of all over. So it looked like a toy. And every time she tried to feed it using a syringe, it'd go, ah, and bite her or do this. And I thought, this is inhumane. This is so inhumane. Because it had all kinds of crusty stuff all over its face and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, I know that this woman has a good heart, but she's doing what people do all the time, which is putting her own desires in front of the needs of the animals. And she doesn't think she is, because she thinks that she's communicating with them.
I was going to say, she talked to the cat too?
She talks to all animals. Yeah. And so it was really sad, actually, because either of these dogs could live somewhere else very, very happily, and apparently have. But she wants them to all live happily under the same roof, which is, it's a real shame. Anyway.
It's interesting, though, because she wants you to communicate with them, but they're communicating with her.
They're telling me stuff all the time. And she wants me to communicate with them what she wants me to communicate with them.
Yeah.
She doesn't want me to communicate what I'm thinking.
So what did you tell her?
I told her that her management was fine, that I gave her a few exercises to do with the dogs, having the dogs fairly close to each other. And I said, give me a call in a couple months when you're ready to take the dogs for a walk together and I'll walk with you. Which I should not have said, because I don't want to ever see her again. But, yeah. And there are very few clients. You know, I see maybe usually 7-8 clients a week, something like that. I love my clients. They're wonderful. So it's odd for me to say, you know, this person is just so, and it, you know, just wrong for me, I guess, you know. Okay. So just to kind of add to that, dogs are dogs. Dogs are who they are. The dogs are, you were talking about the whole science thing, and I think you can't forget that dogs are dogs. Even the Baileys, Bob and Marion Bailey said that, you know, in the end, instinct will out. You cannot override the dog when you're trying to teach the dog how to learn. So these behaviors, these instinctive behaviors, come at different times. Each behavior that dogs have, you know, you have no idea how many people say to me, you know, like, oh, he's 7 months old, he's suddenly acting odd, but he's never done this before. As though 6 months of life is going to give you who the dog is. You know, 6 months of life is just the early life of a dog. And so at 7 months, they may very well start changing. And at 9 months, they may start changing. And the horrible thing is, at 12 years, they may start changing, because the only consistent thing about behavior is that it never stops changing. Behavior learning always takes place. So learning happens whether we're teaching or not. Learning is happening. Here's a really good example. Aspen. Right? What has she learned since she's been here? That this is an absolutely spectacular place to beg for food.
Yes. Well,
yeah.
This is the treat.
Yeah, yeah. She's learned that this is what you do if you want to get treats, then you come in here and you look cute and you'll get treats. Well, she's 6 years old. And she says, yes, and I've learned it well. Yeah. So the other thing about dogs is, or one of the things about dogs, is that their brains are very malleable, which means that they can learn what we teach. And what that has led to, in my opinion, is that people who think that dogs learn everything we want them to learn and everything that we want to teach them. And that's not true. They can learn a great deal, but they can't learn everything that we want them to teach. So when we teach a dog something, if it's instinctive, if it's something that isn't something that goes with their instincts, they probably aren't going to need that much reinforcement. They will get a lot of intrinsic reinforcement, but if it's something against their instincts, they will need a lot of reinforcement, which of course is why people who think that they took their dog to a Family Dog 1 class or beginning level class, they think their dog is going to know these behaviors for the rest of its life. And will it? No, of course not. Because everything we teach in obedience, it goes against the dog's instincts. Come, sit, stay, down, heel. Dogs naturally walk near us, but they don't, you know, try putting a person on a leash and see how that works for you. So there are so many caveats to learning that you have to, I mean, we're going to talk about the quadrants and whatnot, but I'm probably not going to talk about as much as like if you took Gene Donaldson's course or whatever, because I think that they are irrelevant when you take life into consideration. So years ago, when we were first learning, and by we, I mean the first people in AP, the Association of Professional Dog Trainers, the APDT, we were first learning about operant conditioning. We learned about it from the trainers, the dolphin trainers, you know, like Karen Pryor. In fact, Karen Pryor herself was the biggest one. And for those of us who train dogs, we came across a real problem right away, which has since been shoved under a rug somewhere. I don't know why. But that is that dolphins are captive. So you can be a zoo trainer, and you can teach a giraffe to hold its leg out to get a shot, right? It's because he needs to get the husbandry to get a shot. So you can use operant conditioning to do that. But what would happen if you put that giraffe on a savanna? You think he'd be anywhere near the shot? No, of course not. So when you're working with a captive animal, you can do all kinds of things that you cannot do with an animal in its normal environment. And for dogs, that means living with us. That's their normal environment. And there are also so many variabilities. So that's something that no matter what we talk about over the next 3 weeks, this is really important to remember this, that all learning is contingent on the environment. There is nothing that you can teach a dog that will work in all environments. In fact, Marion was talking before class about teaching dogs to go through the metal detectors at airports. And the people wanted the dogs to go through first without any kind of metal on their body. And these poor dogs are very confused because how are they supposed to know what they're supposed to be doing? They're, you know, they can't. So they haven't, they may have been able to go from point A to point B in a learning circumstance, you know, like in a dog training pavilion or something like that, but that doesn't mean they're going to be able to take that learning and apply it in an airport with a whole bunch of people around and people staring at them. It's not going to happen. So human beings, this is the other part I added, human beings have an executive brain. You know, there's the amygdala, the mammalian brain, and then there's this, this cerebral cortex that we've got, and that's an executive brain, and that tells us what to focus on. So that's always, always saying, okay, you guys are going to look at this this screen, or I'm going to look at you, or whatever. So our executive function is telling us what to do. We have to use our executive function. Da-da. So it's not an option. So if you see, you know, I get up in the morning, I look at Mount Burdell, I see that there's fog on Mount Burdell. Maybe the fog is here, and then the mountaintop is here. I fill in the mountain. You know, I don't see a floating mountaintop, right? I fill in the mountain because that's part of our executive function. That's what we do with our brain. We take all the available information and we put it into one part of our brain, and our brain says, this is relevant, this isn't, this is relevant, this isn't, fill in this thing or whatever. And so, which is why when you have an eyewitness account of a murder, it's never right. Because somebody is busy, somebody's executive function is busy filling in all this information and adding little extraneous details that might not actually exist to make sense of the whole thing. That make sense to you? Okay. So we see a partial anything, we fill in the rest. Animals see everything all the time. So they're constantly seeing details. And this is what Temple Grandin talks about in Animals in Translation, for those of you who have read that. If you have not read it yet, how many of you have not read it yet? If you have not read it yet, read it. It's just so good. It's just, and you can listen to it while you're working or something like that, because it's so excellent. Because she's autistic, and so she sees things the way animals see things. So it's really fascinating. So they see details. They are very detail oriented. They will see the top of the mountain only because the fog is, you know, is hiding the bottom part. And they believe everything they see. So there you are trying to work with a reactive dog going, okay, what is this dog seeing? Because we don't know what they're seeing because we're filling in all this stuff and they're seeing something entirely different. And we cannot put our brain in their brain. We just can't do it. So a really good example at the Marine Humane Society is you teach classes in the pavilion. In the pavilion is this building that for about 25 years I tried to get a better floor in. It never has worked.
They're supposed to be doing that.
Are they really? Okay, I'll believe it when I see it. Honest to God. I'd go out there once a year. Please, can we have a better floor? But what they have is they have this bank of windows. It's like right here to the sidewalk. So you're having a class inside, and people come and they look. Yeah. See what's going on, and the dogs all go because those are disembodied heads. Those heads have no bodies. They do not have the function, the executive function, to be able to fill in the rest of the body. If you took them around the corner and they go, "Well, those are people. Oh, that's good. Yeah, they're people." And then you bring it back in, and they go all over again, because no, they can't get enough light. It's a pretty dark room. Yeah, they actually need it. But we did put window film in. We would cover it with paper, just like this, sometimes. Especially for difficult dog class, for the aggressive dog class, because, boy, they really... So some dogs are very capable of going, okay, I don't know what it is, but everything's been good so far. I'm sure it won't bother me very much. But then you have these reactive dogs who are like, I can't handle this. Not at all. There's nothing I can handle here. So that's a real big difference in our brains. And when you're teaching a dog anything or trying to teach a dog anything, you have to keep that in mind. You know, that our executive function is telling us one thing and they are seeing something completely different. And you can't help. We are the hero of our own story. We cannot look at life through somebody else's eyes. You think you can, but you really can't. And when you're trying to do it with a different species, you know, notwithstanding saying, you know, this dog is sentient and you can tell him what you want, it doesn't work that way. So this is a great, and you probably have seen this this experiment a long time. It was about, I think, in 2010? Yeah, 2010. So just follow along with this and do the experiment. I'm hoping I really did put this up today. So.
The monkey business illusion. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball.
Okay.
The correct answer is 16 passes.
Okay. So what'd you guys see?
The monkey business.
Who saw the gorilla? Who did not see the gorilla? About half.
I did not. I was so focused on the white.
Yeah. You saw the gorilla. Who knew? Did you know about this study? Okay. Isn't this a great thing? That's our executive function. That's us going, it is not relevant, I am not seeing it. You want to see it again?
Yes.
Okay.
We're so focused.
Yeah. This is our executive function. This is our focus. Isn't this cool? Yeah.
This illusion. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the ball.
The correct answer is 16, so you don't have to count.
Oh my god. It's so obvious.
It even stops in the middle. I just love that experiment.
The answer is 16 passes.
No, exactly the same video.
Did you spot the gorilla?
I don't trust myself.
For people who haven't seen or heard about a video like this before,
about half missed the video.
If you knew about the gorilla, you probably saw it. But did you notice the curtain changing color or the player on the black team leaving the game?
You want to see it again?
Let's rewind and watch it again. Here comes the gorilla, and there goes a player, and the curtain is changing from red to gold.
Yeah, I know the color. It's much lighter.
It's the color's very different.
When you're looking for a gorilla, you often miss other unexpected events. And that's the monkey business illusion.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Learn more about this illusion and the original gorilla.
So, you know, go home and play that for your significant other and see if they spot the gorilla.
Would a dog see the gorilla?
Yes, a dog would see the gorilla. Yeah, a dog would see them for sure. They wouldn't probably take much notice of it because it's just another human being as far as they're concerned. Yeah, and they're not busy counting the white and they're not doing that. But I mean, it's just so fascinating when you think about learning what is there and what is not there. Both are equally important and things that you need to bear in mind always when you're teaching your dog. So this by the way is called inattentional blindness. Or selective reality, depending on whether you are scientific or you like Ram Dass. I like Ram Dass. But selective reality is essentially, you know, you will not notice a dry cleaner store until you need dry cleaning. You will not notice, you know, any kind of thing. You don't notice it until you need it. And so half the time you're like, I saw this somewhere. And then it's like three blocks from your house. Right, so that's inattentional blindness. That's a really important consideration when you're a human being trying to learn something. The inattentional blindness affects learning for us and colors how we think dogs learn. We think dogs learn the same way that we do, and they do not. They absolutely learn they are certain things that they do learn very in similar fashions, but they always have a different way of looking at something. Dogs are very much place learners. We are also place learners. In fact, one of my clients this week was complaining that her child was very different at school than she is at home, because she has learned to be a certain way at home and she has learned to be a certain way at school, and that's the way it is. So that their kids are place learners. Adults are place learners in that many of us function better if you work in an office, you work better when you are in the office with other people than you do when you are at home, or vice versa. So we are also place learners. Dogs are extremely specific place learners. So if they learn something in your kitchen, many times they can't do it in the living room, or certainly when they're outside in the yard. And it means that when you're talking to your clients and trying to help your clients teach your dog something, they teach their dog something, they have to remember to place the behaviors in different places. This is one reason why I usually recommend that they teach sit everywhere. You know, you're always asking the dog to sit, because if nothing else, sit teaches the dog to stop and pay attention to something. A little bit, not necessarily a whole bunch. But every time you go to a new environment, particularly if you're working with a fearful dog, of course, you have new obstacles to the dog's learning, because they are thinking about everything else that's in the environment. Okay, so this is going to be fun. Okay, I want you all to close your eyes and tell me how many cabinets are in this room. How many cabinets are in this room? Just close your eyes and just mark down on a piece of paper or something. How many cabinets are in this room? Okay. How many? Huh? There's the six over there. You've got guys probably didn't even see that. That's right.
There's six over here.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then there's some down here, and then there's some over here, you know. So did you know, I mean, I couldn't tell you how many there are. We I didn't notice them. They're totally irrelevant to doing this. In fact, I look around here and I go, oh, I don't even think I noticed that.
I just saw that before.
You know, which is a pretty big thing, right? So this is actually my ex-husband is a contractor. He notices things like that. He's got that kind of brain, and he really notices stuff like that. Okay, any questions about that? That's just kind of an overall look. And now we're going to talk about different kinds of learning. So there are two stages of learning. There's, I mean, generically, when we're talking about dogs and people for that matter, there's acquisition, when the animal is first learning something. And then there's maintenance, which is when the behavior has been learned and the expectation is that that behavior will be performed. The vast majority of people think that maintenance has been achieved when the dog is still in acquisition. So say you were doing this place learning thing, right? And so you're teaching a dog something in the kitchen, then the living room, then outside, and then one other place outside, right? Now you think, okay, my dog knows it. I mean, this happens in dog training classes all the time, doesn't it?
Molly's
right here.
Molly, come.
If you need her to go outside. She says, but I'm good here. But if you've only done this behavior like three or four different places, the dog still has not gone into maintenance yet. And in fact, I think that it's a major problem with all kinds of different behaviors that we're trying to teach our dogs. That people go from, it's like the biggest complaint you hear as a trainer is, I don't want to use treats. And, you know, it must be getting close to my time to retire, because at this point I'm like, okay. So now I have a little spiel that I give. I say, okay, so when you're teaching, when you're trying to teach something to a dog, and you're trying to make them pay attention to you, who are not a very interesting individual, I mean, because you're old hat, not because you're not a fantastically intelligent human being, But when you're trying to teach something, a dog something, you have two choices. You can either teach through fear, so they're afraid of you, or you can teach through hope. They want something. They're going to earn something. I used to say fear and greed, and people got all mad at me. But I do think hope is right, because it adds in an anticipation in the whole thing. And then we talk about, you know, adding interest to people and whatnot, because most of my clients don't want to use anything that's compulsive or painful, but they want the dog to do it because they love them, and they don't understand that the dog is intrinsically motivated to do completely other things, nothing at all remotely like what they want them. They want to go eat poop, for Christ's sake. This is not a human being. And I don't know of any people who want to eat poop. So anyway, maintenance is something that takes longer to get to than you think, and needs at least some sporadic reinforcement throughout the dog's whole life, you know, and that's just the way it is. When I go to a client's house, if it's going to be something with training and it's not just almost all clients, I give everybody one of these. They get one for free because I want them to understand that this is not optional. Yeah, I can occasionally use a pinch collar or whatever, but I'm always going to use reinforcement. Always going to use that. Consequently, Woof Hoof really likes me because I buy these things in bulk. Okay, so reflex and cognition, we've talked about this in some other classes, but they're still very important. A reflex is very different from cognitive behavior. A reflex is an involuntary action or response, like a sneeze, a blink, a hiccup, something like that. Reflexive behaviors would also be like when the light flickered a little while ago, which of course I did on purpose. Okay, did everybody look up towards the light? Did anybody not look up towards the light? You did not? Mm-mm. You're just not maybe light sensitive or something? But you didn't. I did. I looked up. And I actually commented, so most everybody did, right? If there was a knock at the door, would you look towards the door, right? Yeah, so that's a reflex behavior. It's not like, and you'd have to know the person is coming in and want not to to do it, to not look at the door when somebody came to the door.
Yeah. Let's say, because these lights have flickered before and they've gone off before, if that's happened a few times, would it be more likely they'd just be like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, because now it's gone from your reflexive to your cognitive brain. So reflexive brain is part of the hindbrain, right? So these are things that just happen like that because nature made it so that if there's something that threatens you, you better know about it really, really fast. So, and I love the way Temple Grandin puts it. She says, you know, the amygdala is the primitive brain, the lizard brain, and then on top of that is mammalian brain, and then on top of that is the human brain, because nature, if the lizard brain worked, why get rid of it for the mammals? Just add more. So it's 2.1, 2.2, you know? So, but what happens then is that we literally have three brains. We literally, that when you think about it, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? You've got all these reflexes that go on in your amygdala, and there's your executive brain going, no, don't worry about that. No, don't worry about that. Because that's trying to make sense of this whole thing. So, other things that are reflex behaviors, things that we are definitely involved in the dog world, is like, you pull, I pull back. What's it called now?
Opposition
reflex. And it happens all the time. And I use it constantly, and I'm sure you do too, in whatever you do with dogs. So you don't have to think about a reflexive behavior, but at the same time, reflexive behaviors are the bane of our life. Because you're walking along the street with the dog sees something or hears something that is a scary noise or whatever, and reflexively does something that you didn't want them to do, and they tear your arm off. You know, so those are things that occur all the time, constantly. And by the way, for those of you guys who are new here, you can always ask questions at any given time, any time you want to, or not, depending on what you want. Okay, so cognition is that voluntary actions or response to stimuli. And cognitive behaviors can take place only one at a time. So you cannot do three cognitive behaviors at the same time, no matter what you think, while you're driving down the road trying to read your email or you're texting. You can't do it. Oh, that was the other thing I was going to say. This whole thing with the dogs and the and their, you know, our executive function, which teaches us to focus and all that. We are in the process right now of actually completely screwing that up. You know that? Because as you're walking here, everything's fine, huh? It's on my phone. Okay, that's our reflexive brain. Kick it in over and over. This is interesting. I gotta get this.
So it's gone from cognition,
we're reflexive, but so many people are so reflexive about their, they don't even know they're doing it. They're picking up their phone, they're looking at it. And they've said it is that primitive part of our brain that keeps on looking for danger over and over and over and over again. And so you can watch it, and especially in the younger generation, they walk around all the time with the phone in their hand, and they're just looking at it all the time. And it's not even when there's a notification or something. So we're turning back into mammal, we're dropping some of our executive function. I think that's fascinating. Okay, so anyway, cognitive actions can only take place one at a time. So if you are teaching somebody something, you have to remember that you have to be very careful about it. So this yesterday with Zumadi, I was teaching them to, we ended up going, okay, let's stick with the pinch collar for the time being. Oh, the guy was saying that he thought the dog had PTSD because of the pinch collar and e-collar, and I think he's probably right. And so I said, well, we'll go ahead and keep on using the pinch collar because he's got this big muzzle on and he's way too strong for a harness. So I said, okay, let's try it, and then we can switch over and see if we can find another kind of compromise if this doesn't work. So I had to show them how to use the pinch collar correctly. And it took them 5-6 minutes to kind of get this, even though to me it's a very simple behavior because it's just that when the dog pulls, you pause, and then the dog goes and decides to go backwards. So that's the whole thing about using a pinch collar, you know, is that the dog is going to decide to go backwards. And it took me a long time to teach him because he's so used to this reflexive behavior now of popping the leash every time the dog pulls. And we see this all the time, right? Okay, so there are lots of types of learning, and I'm going to go into all of them. Social learning, which can be facilitational or observational. Classical conditioning, where events are linked with no action on the part of the animal. Non-associative learning, where the events are not linked. Operant conditioning, where the behavior produces the event. And natural learning, which I think of as being, you know, learning despite us instead of because of us. So here are a few different types of learning. This is for your listening pleasure.
So good, it's right. southern sky.
Her posing. She does that every day. Here I am, adorable. Okay. So you saw the things on there, the operant conditioning. You know, the whole thing about learning is a mess, isn't it? You think the dog is learning one way and they're really learning something else. So like the little puppy that was playing with the adult, that's social learning. The dog is learning how to interact with another dog, right? But at the same time, that other dog was pretty rough. That was a client of mine. And we had to stop the dog from being too rough because I did not want the dog to learn that other dogs were dangerous. So, and that would have been single event learning, which is something we'll go into, you know. The dog pulling on the leash, you know, where it's like the person's holding the dog and the dog's pulling it, that dog is learning that it can pull its owner. So that's operant conditioning. The dog is going, got it, I know how to do this now. And the dog that was dancing on the deck, he's doing the same thing. You know, look what I can do. I can make you follow me by just doing this little dance, you know. So we tend to think in our doggy society, we have this tendency to think that operant conditioning is when I'm teaching the dog to do something and the dog is learning how to do it. But that's not the case. Operant conditioning, any of those things, just they can exist totally without human beings. No problem at all.